Russian television showed charred bodies being carried away on stretchers and many damaged cars and buildings in the area next to the market. Today's bombing is the deadliest since March, when twin suicide bombers blew themselves up in Moscow's metro system, killing 40 and injuring more than 100 others. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Gallagher in Moscow.
The Transportation Department says the number of highway deaths in the U.S. has fallen to its lowest level in 6 decades. Officials say the reason for the improvement include more people wearing seatbelts and the fact that cars are being equipped with better safety features. Positive economic reports out today are being welcomed on Wall Street. The Dow is currently up 55 points. The Nasdaq Composite has gained 12 points. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Public Notice, an independent organization dedicated to reducing government spending. Learn more at thepublicnotice.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Friday, an NPR News special, live anchored coverage of President Obama's news conference. This is Mr. Obama's first full-scale question and answer session at the White House in nearly 4 months. The president is expected to focus on the economy. I'm Jennifer Ludden. Join me for in-depth coverage and analysis. It's an NPR News special, President Obama's news conference, Friday.
At 10 a.m. on AM 580.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, I'm sorry to say that we were not able to make contact with our scheduled guest for the first hour, Eliza Griswold. She's a journalist and has written an interesting book. It's titled The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. It's gotten a lot of positive attention, a lot of good reviews, and we're sorry we couldn't find her, but we'll see if we can get that program scheduled for another day, and we'll come back to the topic. So instead, we'll go to the Focus archives for something completely different. We will be back live in our second hour, talking with Jacob Hacker about economic insecurity in the country. So I hope you can stay with us. In this part of the show, we'll be talking about the story behind the building of Hoover Dam. This year, the dam turns 75. At the time that it was constructed, it was the biggest federal project ever, with a price tag of $108 million. Author Michael Hiltzik says also it was the first sign of the expanding political influence of the West. It was also the beginning of a period of rapid change for the country. He says that the story of America in the last half of the 20th century is the story not of the post-war era, but of the post-dam era. This morning, in this hour of the show, we will talk with Michael Hiltzik about his new book. It's titled Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century. Free Press is the publisher of the book. It is just out, and I'm sure that you can find it out in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. Our guest is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. He's written about business, technology, and public policy for the Los Angeles Times for 3 decades. Currently, he is the business columnist for the Times. He's also served as a political and financial writer and investigative reporter. He received the Pulitzer Prize in 1999 for articles that he wrote exposing corruption in the entertainment industry. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And Mr. Hiltzik, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much. Well, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. You know, I really want to say at the beginning that before getting into the story, I would never have thought that the story behind this dam was as fascinating as it is, and that it goes in as many different directions and touches on so many different areas of American life.
Well, that's true, and it's something that I found as well as I was researching the book, that the story got richer the deeper I got into it, which is what you want when you're writing a book and spending 3 years or so with a subject.
And I think you make a big argument here, but I think that it's one that you can follow through, that that not only would the West not be what it is today without this dam, but you might go as far as to make the argument that America wouldn't be what it is today without the dam.
That's certainly true, and one of the reasons for that is that this dam really became the model of the reach of the federal government in terms of building public works. The dam was conceived decades before it was built as an important addition to regional infrastructure. But it was the participation of the federal government that really made it happen, and it was such an enormous project, and it became such a center of national attention that it really set the stage for many, many projects to come.
Mm-hmm. There's something else that I think is important here, and something that I think also you want people to understand, is that this time when the dam was built, the 1930s, was probably the golden age of American civil engineering, and that a number of major projects were built around that point that contributed to the economic boom that happened in America later, after World War II.
That's very true. In fact, there are historians who've examined this period and come to the conclusion that in many ways it was the most technologically advanced period in American history, certainly over the last 100 years. Now, even while Hoover Dam was being built, the Golden Gate Bridge was going up. It was being built by some of the same contractors, in fact, who were working in the Nevada Gorge. The dam, Hoover Dam, was the template for many, many other dams that were built. The notion that America had needed to build up its technological infrastructure became very important at that time, and oddly enough, for a period in which the country was undergoing a great economic crisis and had some doubts as to how and even whether it would be able to pull itself out of that, we spent billions of dollars before we were done in building up this infrastructure and really developing a great deal of technical know-how that we didn't have going in.
Mm-hmm. I've never been there, and so my only experience of it, the only thing that I can do is look at photographs, and I'm sure that the experience of actually being there and seeing it is not something that can be conveyed by a photograph.
Well, photographs help a lot. You can certainly get a sense of the majesty and the power of the structure. But even Franklin Roosevelt, who the anniversary of whose dedication of the dam we'll be celebrating at the end of September, he understood that that you have to go see it to really get a sense of just the accomplishment. You come down into the gorge, you come around a cliffside, and all of a sudden, right in front of you, is this just beautiful alabaster work of human hands set in the midst of a very forbidding natural setting. And the style of it, the architectural style of it, as well as the technical power of it, is when it comes together, it's something that nobody who's seen it in person really ever forgets.
Yeah. There are so many great stories connected with the dam. One, for example, is that the tangled story behind the name of the dam. We call it Hoover Dam for Herbert Hoover, but at the time that it was dedicated by Franklin Roosevelt, he didn't call it Hoover Dam. In fact, Mr. Hoover wasn't even invited.
That's right. Mr. Hoover wasn't invited to the dedication, and his name was not uttered once during the dedication. There are a lot of ironies connected with the naming, renaming, and re-renaming of the dam. The dam was initially named after Hoover by his own Interior Secretary, who sprung this on his listeners at the groundbreaking ceremony in September 1930. He talked about what a great engineering achievement this was going to be, and then he said, by the way, because of that, I'm going to name it after the great engineer who heads our government, and that's Herbert Hoover. Now, that was fair enough because Hoover had actually become famous and made his fortune as an engineer, but it didn't sit well with a lot of people who really had a lot to do with getting the dam off the ground, and that's because although Hoover did play an important role, this was not the dam that he wanted built. His objection to it was that it was a high dam and it was going to generate electricity paid for by the taxpayers. And he was dead set against the notion of public power. His argument was, if private enterprise can do something, we ought to let them do it. We should not intercede. He had a lot of friends in the private utility industry. They were dead set against this dam, and he saw things their way. And in fact, over the 10 years before the groundbreaking, he had tried to do a lot to torpedo this project. He wanted a much lower dam, much further down on the river, that would function only as a flood control structure and an irrigation supply, not this very important element that the dam has today, which is generating hydroelectric power.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, his name got placed on it. 3 years later, he's succeeded by the Roosevelt administration and Roosevelt's Interior Secretary, Harold Ickes, who happened to be a Republican and was an anti-Hoover Republican, summarily took Hoover's name off the dam. He instructed Elwood Meade, who was then the head of the Reclamation Service, said, henceforth, we're going to call it Boulder Dam because that's where it is. It's in Boulder Canyon. Now, Ickes was wrong about that. The dam is not in Boulder Canyon. It's 20 miles further downstream. But for the next 14 years, that's what it was officially called, Boulder Dam. Ickes arranged for a commemorative U.S. postage stamp to be issued with the name of Boulder Dam. He said he wanted it to be sure that I've nailed down this name so that Hoover's no longer associated with it. As you said, Roosevelt, at the dedication, did not invite Hoover. Hoover's name was not mentioned, which irritated Republicans, which there were still quite a few in the country at the time. And then in 1947, when the Republicans took over Congress for the first time in 14 years, they put Hoover's name back on the dam. By then, Hoover was in somewhat better odor in among Americans. He had done a lot in terms of post-war relief. The depression in memory had begun to ebb, and it's been Hoover Dam ever since.
And just one sort of further wrinkle, it's ironic that Franklin Roosevelt took ownership of the dam, kind of folding it into the whole project of the New Deal, even though it's a project that was really launched by the Republicans. It was Calvin Coolidge who signed off on this. And when Roosevelt was running for president in 1932, he actually attacked Herbert Hoover for big spending on projects just like this.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. In fact, the ironies go back even further. The dam... The idea of damming the Colorado in this way actually dates back to Theodore Roosevelt, mm-hmm. also a Republican president, who first told Congress that he thought it was the federal government's job to take on a task this big. And then, as you said, Coolidge actually signed the bill into law that appropriated the money for the dam, and Hoover launched it. He accelerated construction several years before it normally would have been done to address unemployment in the country. But Roosevelt, for all that he had attacked Hoover for his public work spending during the campaign, as soon as he became president, he understood that the totemic power of a great structure like this, and he understood how much attention it was getting across the country, and he understood very well that it would profit his administration to appropriate it, to identify it with the New Deal, and he did that very effectively. In fact, many, many people who I've talked to about the dam, who've asked me about it, are under the impression that the whole project was a WPA project, that is a New Deal construction project. And that's simply not true. In fact, the WPA barely got involved at all.
Mm. Well, it is really just interesting, and I'll get to some callers here in a moment, that though apparently they're in the dam in places where pretty much nobody gets to go, there is a lot of artwork there that was done by the WPA.
Yes, that's right. These were designs that were done by an artist named Alan Tupper True. He's not very well known anymore, although if you have been to Wyoming or you've seen a Wyoming automobile, there's a picture of a cowboy on a bucking bronco on the Wyoming license plates. To this day, that's an Alan Tupper True design. True exploited the designs of the Southwestern Indians to create these wall designs and floor designs in the mosaic. He thought it was understood at the time that there would be galleries and corridors within the dam that people would be walking through, that there would be tours, that there would be enough interest for people to be invited in to see the work, the workmanship. Now, over the years, obviously, the access that the general public has to the interior of the dam has shrunk year after year, and after 9/11, it really got cut back. So, the general public doesn't have much of a chance to see some of the great handiwork and craftsmanship inside the dam. You get a very constrained view when you take the official tour.
We have a couple of callers here. Let me just quickly introduce again the guest, Michael Hiltzik. He is the author of a new book that tells the story of the building of Hoover Dam. The title is Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century, and it's published by the Free Press. We have a couple of callers here, someone who is a local to start us off, line one here in Champaign-Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Comment on Kaiser. He had a role in that, and how did he get it? And supposedly, because they were in a desert far from everything, he set up one of the first HMOs to care for workers. But also, comment on the cofferdam. How did they manage to build a base and yet channel the water somehow? Okay.
Okay.
Well, those are two very good questions. Yes, it's true. Henry Kaiser was one of the contractors. The actual contracting consortium was known as six companies. It was six major contractors all coming together, and they had to come together because this was such a big job. Kaiser was one of them, and Warren Bechtel, whose heirs now run the Bechtel Corporation, was another one. They were probably the two most important builders of the dam. And it's true, one of the things that the contractors did was they set up their own hospital and medical clinic on the work site, that is, within the federal reservation where the dam was being built. They charged the workers a few dollars or a couple of dollars a month for all sorts of medical care. Now, they didn't cover the workers' families. They still had to go 28 miles into Las Vegas to get medical care. But yes, it's true. This was a model that Kaiser then implemented at his shipyards and his steel plants, and obviously, eventually, it became Kaiser Permanente. But this was the first expression of it at the Hoover Dam site.
And I guess the other question has to do with the fact that here, when they were building the dam, what they had to do was actually build another dam a little further upstream so they could hold back all the water while they were building the main dam.
That's correct. They actually had to build two extra dams. They had to build one upstream of the concrete site and one downstream so that the riverbed would be dry. Now, in fact, the first and in some ways most expensive part of the project was the task of diverting the Colorado. And what they did was they drove four diversion tunnels, each one almost a mile in length, through solid rock, two on either side of the riverbed. In November 1932, actually a week or two after Hoover had lost his job in the election, they diverted the river. They opened those diversion tunnels. The Colorado started flowing around the riverbed to a mile downstream. That allowed them to dewater the bed. Then they began building the cofferdams to make sure that the river would not interfere with the work of 5,000 men on dry land, actually pouring the concrete. That was an enormous task. Almost everything that's associated with this dam is a huge project in itself, and the diverting of the river was, for the first time, by the hand of man, the Colorado was moved out of its path and around this canyon. It was a great achievement, and it was something that required inventing a lot of techniques and inventing a lot of equipment to accomplish, and that's another aspect of the story, that almost everything, every method, every technique, every piece of equipment that was used to build this dam had to be invented on the site.
Mm. Just because nothing of this scale had been done before?
That's right. Nothing of this scale. The challenges that they faced, diverting the river, getting men and material down 700 feet, in some sections 1,000 feet down into the gorge, all of these things, and at pouring concrete in the middle of nowhere, they had to develop cableways that would enable concrete buckets to be transported overhead and then down to the pour site and then opened essentially by remote control. All of this was invented, mostly new. One other aspect, because you're pouring mass concrete, concrete of this volume had never been poured in a mass before. They had to develop new ways of cooling the concrete, because if they didn't do that, to this day, that concrete would still be drying out and would continue to be drying and curing for another 100 years. So they embedded refrigeration pipes in the dam as they were building it. They pumped cold water through to cool it off, and yet another technique that was really pioneered at this.
Yeah, it's an amazing engineering feat, and not only did they manage to accomplish it under all these difficult conditions, they actually came it was accomplished before the deadline that had been set, sooner than they had thought.
Well, in fact, 2 years ahead of schedule, which is an amazing achievement.
Another caller here, someone in Effingham, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you, David. Your guest just spoke of the totemic effect of the structure, and what I'm asking, if he would then explain the taboos and what the environment suffered as a result of this thing. Thank you.
All right. Environmental impact, which was something that at the time people didn't think about that, or at least they didn't think about it the way we think about it now.
Well, they didn't think about it at all. Environmental protection in the way we think about it really is an artifact of the 1960s, I think, and 1970s. There were a lot of obstacles to building this dam, but environmental concerns were not among them. The idea that you have to think about downstream effects, which are surely enormous, that you have to think about the effect on downstream communities or on historical artifacts which have been inundated beneath Lake Mead, that was not part of the planning process for this dam, although the very first project for archaeological preservation connected with a dam was done at Hoover Dam. It was just done by a single researcher who happened to be interested, although he established a model once again for the future. But there's no question that there are habitats that were destroyed by Hoover Dam. There are probably species that were eradicated that we will never know about because they're lost to history. There were political concerns that were simply brushed aside. The right to water from the Colorado of Indian tribes that were downstream, or the entire nation of Mexico, were completely disregarded so that this dam could be built by the federal government. As I think your caller has a sense of, we take these things very seriously today, especially the environmental impact of structures like this. If Hoover Dam were to be built today, there would be years, maybe more than a decade, of environmental studies that would have a great effect on how the dam was situated and how it was operated. And in fact, the United States is getting out of the habit of building dams, in part because we understand much more about these ancillary effects and these collateral effects. We're even taking some dams down where it's determined that they're no longer performing the function that they used to, and they're having a much more deleterious effect on the ecology in comparison. Now, in other countries are still in the dam building phase, especially countries like China, which is putting up huge projects. But in this country, I think we've come to a much better understanding that dams are, in general, very expensive ways to produce water supply, and they have effects that if you really factor everything in, they're even more expensive. Mm.
Well, I think at least one of the reviews of the book that I looked at posed some interesting questions that in the same area. The questions being, number one, could we actually build something like this today? And if we'd say, well, yes, we could, would we?
Well, that's a very good question. And it's a question that I do address in the book because it is so important. The question of whether Hoover Dam could be built today, certainly technologically we could do it. I think politically, under certain circumstances, we would be able to do it, although there was a huge political tussle over building this dam. Even then, it really took 20 years from the moment it was conceived to the groundbreaking because of that. A lot of concerns in the eastern part of the country that this was going to create more agricultural production in the west that was going to compete with the farmers in the east. There was the concern of the private utilities about public power and all these things. It's a little hard to really know if we could build Hoover Dam today because the world that we're looking at today is so much a product of Hoover Dam. The great metropolises of the West, Los Angeles, San Diego, Denver, Salt Lake, Phoenix, Tucson, all of these cities owe a lot of their growth to the world that Hoover Dam made, and some of them much more directly to the water and power that it produces. And so if you look at the world today, it really is Hoover Dam's world, at least in that part of the country.
Yeah, and that also gets to another point, and certainly it's another thing that you deal with, is that without a doubt, this dam made the West and made it, Los Angeles, Phoenix, Denver, Salt Lake City, just as they are today, wouldn't exist without the dam. The fact is that it also set the region on a course of development that some people say isn't sustainable. So at one time, the promise was this dam was going to generate more water than anybody could ever use, and now in the West, people are talking about water shortages.
That's right. In fact, the dam was sold to the seven states of the Colorado River Basin as a project that was going to produce create more water supply than they could ever exploit in their wildest dreams. And that was necessary because if any of those states got the impression that there were going to be limits on how much water they could use, they would not have approved the dam. They would have been fearful that California, which then as now is the 800-pound gorilla in that region, would take everything. And California would have taken everything. That's really what they wanted. And in many ways, this dam was a project really designed for California. But in the years since the dam, since the groundbreaking, since 1930, 45 million people, the growth of population in that region, in those seven states, has been 45 million people. And a lot of that growth has been fueled by the dam and its associated project. Now, there never was going to be enough water to be used by all of the projects that all of these states had. That was sort of a fraud perpetrated by the promoters of the dam. Mm-hmm. There never was going to be enough. They overestimated the capacity of the Colorado to generate a water supply. And as a result of that, and also as a result of this unlimited growth, this notion that these states could grow forever, forever, infinitely, we are now in the era of limits. Water policy in the West is much more now concerned with how do we conserve, how do we use the supply we have much more efficiently, because we are at the end of it. We're not going to get more water than we have. We're going to have to find new ways to use what we have. And the conflicts over how to use the water, conflicts between farmers and industry, between industry and urban dwellers, between everybody and ecological needs and environmental needs, they're only going to become more intense. And although Hoover Dam was sold initially as a project that was going to mitigate all of the conflicts that already existed over water in the West, in fact, it hasn't done that. It's mitigated some of those conflicts, but it's promoted other conflicts. And that's another one of the ironies of this project,
yeah,
that we've gone from. The way I put it is that it built the West, but it also put the West in a straitjacket.
And in an interesting way, this brings us back, when we talk about the history of the dam and how it got constructed, that in a way that brings us back to Herbert Hoover, because one of the things that you write about is the fact that, when one questions just what sort of role Hoover had, he was the Commerce Secretary in the run-up phase to this, and he really helped in this business of getting the seven states that were involved, that were all arguing about who was going to get what and who was going to get how much water. He was the one that really helped them come to an agreement. This was in the early 20s, and if that hadn't happened, well, then the project probably wouldn't have gone forward.
Well, that's true. It was actually indispensable that the seven states of the basin come to an agreement because of all of these conflicts about who was going to use the water and who was going to have the right to the water in the Colorado once it was husbanded by this enormous project. So the seven states were told by Congress that they had to sit down and reach an interstate compact. This is a treaty that's permitted in the U.S. Constitution. States can make these treaties. But the seven states had a history of squabbling over exactly this subject. So Warren Harding, who was president at the time, assigned Hoover, who, as you said, was Commerce Secretary, to sit in on these negotiations as adult supervision, essentially. And he made himself the chairman of the negotiating body. And over the course of a year, it was 1922, he hammered out an agreement. It's the Colorado River Compact. It's one of the seminal documents of American history because it apportions water. It basically overrides the case law that had been generated, a very confused case law over who has rights to river water wherever you are. It overrode that. It created its own apportionment, and it set the stage for actually approving the construction of this dam. Now, on the other side of the coin, Hoover's role in those negotiations made him sort of the unofficial expert on all things related to the Colorado River, and that's what gave him the power to try to intercede and block the dam that eventually came to carry his name.
We are a bit past our midpoint here. For anyone who's tuned in the last few minutes, I want to introduce again our guest, Michael Hiltzik. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. He's written about business, technology, and public policy for the Los Angeles Times for three decades. Currently, he is the Times business columnist. He's also served as a financial and political writer, an investigative reporter, also a foreign correspondent in Africa and Russia. His most recent book is Colossus. It's all about the building of Hoover Dam, and it's published by the Free Press. An earlier caller talked about environmental impacts, and I think it's interesting to go way back to the point where people were first starting to talk about a project like this and to talk about the attempts that had been made to harness the Colorado River for irrigation purposes and then to use that for development. And it was something of an environmental disaster, which had a human cause, that really got people thinking about the need to build this dam in the first place. And this was in the early 1900s.
That's right. This was the great flood on the Colorado of 1905. This was the genesis of the dam. Valley, which before it was one of the lushest agricultural zones in the country, was a desert. This is the desert that runs basically from the Colorado River west to the ocean near San Diego. But a number of visionaries in the late 19th century and early in the 20th century understood that if you could irrigate this desert, it would be a Garden of Eden, and they were right about that. Now, the first people who actually achieved that was a group of entrepreneurs who made a cut into the banks of the Colorado around the location of present-day Yuma, Arizona. They ran a canal 50 miles through Mexico and then up to the desert, which they renamed Imperial Valley, and they started irrigating. But they were, on an engineering basis, they were incompetent, and they were, on a financial basis, they were a little bit inclined to fraud, and they didn't do it right. The result was that the Colorado ended up bursting its banks. It inundated the Imperial Valley. It threatened what was already $2 billion a year in annual crop production. And it took 3 years' effort by the Southern Pacific Railroad, ordered to do so by Teddy Roosevelt, to put the Colorado back in its path so that it flowed safely back to the Gulf of California. Now, it was that experience that if you're going to manipulate this very willful, very violent river, you better do it right. That's what gave Teddy Roosevelt the idea that this was a job that only could be done by the federal government, that only the federal government had the resources and the know-how and the ability to take on this task. And that was the genesis of this entire project.
All right, let's take another call. Somebody on the road here, apparently was on Interstate 57, line one. Hi. Oh, good. I'm glad. I always worry about that. If people say that they're on the road, I don't want to cause any accidents.
No. Well, I'll get into this in sort of late, but something seems to be a little bit missing here. I'd like to know what, if any, consideration was given to Mexico in all of this, and whether, when they found probably they had no consideration, if they objected, and if so, how. Thanks. I'll turn it
over. All right. Very good question. What did Mexico have to say about this?
Yes, it's a good question and a relevant question. Mexico had nothing to say at the stage when the seven states were sitting down and negotiating their water rights. And it had nothing to say really until the 1940s when, for the first time, the U.S. government and the Mexican government signed a treaty that governed, among other things, the apportionment of the Colorado River. Now, because Mexico is at the end of the river, it's the furthest downstream user, it really gets short shrift in exploitation of this water. The Colorado, at this point, is the most exploited river, certainly in North America. Every molecule is probably used over and over again many, many times for agriculture, industry. Some of the water is shipped out of the basin to places like Los Angeles. Mexico, at this point, gets the runoff from farms. It's very low-quality water. It's infused with a lot of agricultural chemicals. The Mexicans are always complaining about the quality of the water that they're left as a result of this project and other projects. And some of the steps that we're taking here in the United States to conserve water from the Colorado are only going to make things worse. The All-American Canal, which carries water from the Colorado into Imperial Valley and out to San Diego, we are relining it with concrete so that seepage from the canal can be stopped and all of that water can be kept. But that seepage was water that was making its way to Mexico, and now they're not going to have it anymore. So their quality is going to deteriorate, and their quantity is going to deteriorate. So that's been a very sensitive point for decades and decades and decades, and the Mexicans did not have a voice in the original negotiations, and they haven't had much of a voice since then.
Mm. I want to have you talk some more about one of the major interest groups that was actually opposed to the building of the dam. It tried to derail this project because they saw it as a threat, and that was the public utility companies.
That's right. Well, the public utility companies at the time, they were known as the Power Trust. they were probably the most powerful industry in the United States at the time. You can think of them as the Wall Street bankers of that era. They were nationwide. This was the era of Samuel Insull and utility holding companies. And the power trust manipulated power rates so that their friends in industry got the best rates and residential customers got the worst rates. And because of the utility's reach, this phenomenon grew up of the public power movement, that is a movement for municipalities and other public entities to take over the distribution of power. In the 1920s, the big blow for public power had been sounded by the city of Los Angeles, which condemned and seized Edison Company's power grid within the city and created what we still have is the largest public utility company in the country. But the utility industry understood that once this dam got built and started generating public power on the scale that was anticipated, that generation would create a benchmark price against which their own rates would be measured. So they spent millions of dollars to try to kill this project, and they did it in the most underhanded way. They had front groups. They bribed senators and congressmen. They hired college professors to rewrite their textbooks to build up the role of the utility industry in creating the United States, all these things. And they just spent enormous amounts of money. They would cook up their own initiative campaigns to pass ordinances and laws without really showing that they were behind this, all of the sorts of things that we still see some of them doing today. Now, this all backfired because in the late 20s, the Federal Trade Commission actually started an investigation and disclosed all of these machinations, put thousands of documents out in the press, held hearings that went on for weeks and weeks and weeks, and it so soured the voters on the behavior of the public utility companies that it probably helped get the dam approved by Congress.
This was the dam was built. This was the Depression, and there were people everywhere who desperately needed work, and people came from all around. I think even when the word got out that it was going to be built, even before they started hiring people, people came and they went there just because they had this hope that there would be work. I wanted to have you talk about the labor history here, because actually there are some things about it that are fairly disappointing in terms of disrespect of labor activism, attempts to union, racism. People definitely needed the work, and I'm sure that they wanted the jobs, but it was also very dangerous, and people were hurt, and people were killed. What can you say about that?
Well, that's a very good point. The construction of this dam, the construction project, was in very, very many ways a microcosm of the state of labor relations across the country at the time. Now, as you said, the moment that that people understood that there was going to be this huge project going up in the middle of nowhere in the canyons of the Colorado River, thousands of men migrated to the area in hope of getting jobs. The city of Las Vegas, which was a dusty little railroad depot of 5,000 people at the time, almost overnight swelled to 15,000 people, and that those extra residents were all men looking for work. The contractors, when they got the job, had to put out a public notice saying, do not come to Nevada unless you already have a job or you have a skill that you know we're going to be able to use, because we're not hiring yet. Nevertheless, all these men came. Now, that huge supply of idle employment allowed the contractors to basically have their way with the workers that they did hire. And in fact, the contract they had signed with the federal government gave them almost unrestricted jurisdiction over labor policies and the way they treated the men. So they paid them very low. This was before the Davis-Bacon Act. In fact, it was only a few weeks before the Davis-Bacon Act went into effect, so they were not constrained to pay union scale. There, they probably paid 30% to 40% below what was union scale in Las Vegas to these men. You understood that if you were caught doing something the contractors didn't like, certainly union activity, there were 100 men sleeping in the lawn in front of Las Vegas City Hall who were ready to take your job. Now, the other aspect of this that's very important is that the contractors really had very little regard for the health and safety of their men, even in the context of practice of that era. The first thing that happened was that in the first summer of construction, that's the summer of 1931, there was no work camp. There was no place really for the men to live that was far from the canyon. So they were working in this canyon that concentrated the summer heat like a furnace, and they were living there too, and they had a tremendous number of men who were keeling over from heat stroke. They simply were not doing what they should have. They were not treating these men properly from a medical standpoint, so they had scores of deaths because of heat stroke. A year or two later, when they started drilling these diversion tunnels that we talked about, to save money, they used gasoline-powered equipment underground. It was not the standard of operation even then. The standard was to use electrical machinery underground, but the six companies didn't want to have two fleets of earth-moving equipment. So dump trucks, shovels, all ran on diesel fuel underground. The result was that they gassed a lot of men. A lot of workers died from or were crippled by carbon monoxide poisoning. And what's really distressing about that aspect of the story is that almost always, if the men were injured or killed or died because of this poisoning, their bodies were hauled out of the tunnels. They were shipped to a hospital in Las Vegas where the doctors pronounced them to have died from pneumonia. Now, if you died from pneumonia, you were not eligible for compensation from the companies as a construction injury. So your family was basically left on its own. And there were, once again, scores of men who suffered that way.
And work proceeded around the clock for all of those years. There were only 2 days out of the year where people didn't work, 4th of July and Christmas. Other than that, they just went at it.
That's right. There was such a frenzy. There was so much need to get this job done fast, and the contractors pushed the pace, and their superintendent, a man named Frank Crow, he really pushed the pace because if they missed their deadlines, they were going to be subject to fines of $3,000 a day. And that was a lot of money, and that could have cut into or even eliminated their tremendous profit on this job. So the pace of work was punishing. The work, of course, was dangerous. A lot of corners were cut. Safety on the job, there was lip service paid to it, but really not a lot of focus on it. Three shifts round the clock at the height of construction. The canyon was never silent, except, as you said, for 2 days a year.
Yeah. Herbert Hoover did apparently believe that one good way to fight unemployment was with public works. And so he authorized this, because it was ready to go and there wasn't much else that really was. And it got authorized even though the cost for this one project alone exceeded the entire annual federal construction budget. 10,000 people over the course of the project worked on it, and I'm sure that there were other economic benefits as well. Did overall, for the time, was there a big economic benefit attached to building the dam?
Well, certainly there was a benefit for the region. Las Vegas, this project made Las Vegas, it didn't make it what it is today, but it certainly set it on the path. Las Vegas became the unofficial center of activity for the dam, although Boulder City, which is the work camp, is only 8 miles from the dam, and it was the official residential area. But Las Vegas grew because of it. The power and the water it generated was of immediate and direct benefit to Los Angeles. And yes, certainly it relieved the suffering of, as said, 10,000 workers over the construction period at a time when unemployment in this country was, we don't really know exactly what it was because the government wasn't keeping statistics, but we think it was on the order of 25% nationwide. So this had an important economic effect. And it also, I think indirectly, it gave the country the notion that there was a way to get out of the depression, mm-hmm. and that building big things that were needed was a very effective stimulus.
We're coming down. There's so many good stories here. We're coming down to the point where we maybe have 2-3 minutes left. I want to ask you about one thing in particular, because earlier you talked about just what a remarkable engineering achievement this was, and there's no denying that. But also there was apparently a major problem, something that actually had to be corrected after the dam had already been constructed, which they did, and they really did very quietly.
Yes, well, it's quiet even today. You don't hear about it on the tour. This is the failure of the grout curtain, and I'll just take a quick moment to explain that. When you build a dam, any dam, you get seepage of water from behind the dam, under the foundations, and maybe around the sides, because the reservoir exerts a lot of pressure and a lot of weight. What concerns dam builders and dam engineers is that this water has a tendency to push up on the bulk of the dam and can destabilize it very seriously, can even destroy it. Now, this is a phenomenon called uplift, and to defeat uplift at Hoover Dam, the engineers developed the grout curtain, which was a line of boreholes drilled up to 150 feet deep into the bedrock under the foundations, and they were supposed to be pressure-filled with grout, which is liquefied cement. The grout was supposed to penetrate into the flaws and the cracks and the faults in the bedrock and block the seepage. This was the right thing to do. It was a well-understood engineering idea, but it was also a new idea, and it wasn't done right. The workers didn't really understand how important their job was, so if they if they thought that they'd already put enough grout into a hole, they would move on to the next one. So it was a very imperfect grout curtain. And sure enough, when Lake Mead began filling, just within a year or two, the dam engineers noticed that uplift had reached really alarming levels and was threatening the dam. So they had to go back in and redo the grout curtain. They bored a new set of holes, 2 or 3 times as deep as before. They made sure that they were filled with grout and that grout took. It took 9 years to do that job. That's twice as long as it took to build the dam. It took another $2 million. It was done. You couldn't really do it secretly because people could see the work going on. But it's an aspect of the dam that isn't really widely publicized.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives, conversation with Michael Hiltzik, the author of the book Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century. We had to jump out just a little bit early. You can go and hear the complete interview by going to our website, which is will.illinois.edu. It's a show we first broadcast on July 29th. We'll see if we can reschedule the show that we were going to do for this hour, conversation with Eliza Griswold about her book, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting the community to kick off the 2010-2011 season with the supercharged timba of Miami's Tiempo Libre at the opening night party on Friday, September 10th. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com.
In the next hour, we'll hear live with Jacob Hacker, professor of political science at Yale University. We'll be talking about economic insecurity in the country, so stay with us.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Tom Testdale in Morris at 815-941-2184. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at mid-session, wheat-ish and corn are both showing some strength, while soybeans are retreating off of the opening bell. Let's look at particulars in Kansas City. December wheat at 748.5 is up a quarter. March of 2011 is at 760.75, up 13.75. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade is at 723, up a half. March, 742, up 2.75. September corn, 450.75, up 3.25. December, 465, up 2.5. March, 478.25, up 2.25. July, 485.5, up 1. September soybeans, 10.39, down 2 1/4. November, 10.45, down 3 3/4. January, 10.55, down 3 1/4. Go out to May of 2011, 10.60 1/2, and they are down 5 1/4. September soybean meal is at 306, down 130. September soybean oil is 41.16. It's unchanged. October live cattle, 97, down 25. October feeders, 112, 22 1/2, down.